Tonight is one in a series of water symposia that have been put on through the last several years by Schrader University in partnership with Texas Tech University, Texas Public Radio, the Hill Country Land Trust, and the Hill Country Alliance. And for those of you who are not familiar with the Hill Country Alliance, its Executive Director Christy Muse is here, along with Catherine Romans and Charlie Flatten of their staff, and they're a magnificent engine of collaboration and awareness throughout the Hill Country. I've been in a number of meetings where they have brought county commissioners and environmental groups and all kinds of diverse interests together to talk about issues related to the Hill Country. What we're going to talk about tonight is the Pertinalis Watershed. The Pertinalis River itself is 120 miles long. The watershed itself is over 800,000 acres, which means it's about five times the size of Rhode Island. Only 3% or so of the land in the Pertinalis watershed is in parks or preserves or wildlife management areas, so that means that about 97% of it is owned by private citizens. And that is similar to the situation across the state. The state of Texas, no more than 4 to 5% of all the land in Texas is in public ownership. So Texas is a state of private landowners. Now, many of you probably know, because of the deep sense of history in here in the Fredericksburg area, that the reason for that is that when we became a state, when we came into the United States, we retained our public lands. The Republic of Texas retained its public lands. And then as a state, for the first 70 or so years of our existence, we sold it to finance the government. We built a capital by trading 3 million acres in the Panhandle to a British syndicate. We endowed the A&M and Texas University systems with public lands. Our schools are supported with proceeds from public lands. So that by shortly after the 20th century, virtually the entire state had returned or had become privately owned. And let me tell you, that's been a good thing for us. If you look at accounts of the Texas landscape prior to 1900, say between 1885 and 1905, it was in far worse condition than it is today. By 1890, all of the timber in East Texas had been cut. Most of the state had been so horribly overgrazed that in this part of the state, we lost probably 15 inches of soil. The cedar had come in where before there had been a very lush grassland savanna. So because of the good stewardship of private landowners, assisted by people like Johnny Olenberg and people from Parks and Wildlife and other public agencies, the landscape is better today than it was over 100 years ago. So what does this have to do with water and the watershed that we're discussing tonight? Texas loses rural and agricultural land faster than any other state. We lost over 2 million acres of ranch land and rural agricultural property between 1997 and 2007. No state loses rural and agricultural land as quickly as Texas. And what that means is that all of our watersheds, all of our wildlife habitat, all of our recharge areas, all of the things that we depend on the landscape are at risk as this continued inexorable fragmentation continues. The biggest single terrestrial environmental problem that we have in Texas, and it relates directly to our water supply, is the continued fragmentation of family lands. And so, not only here, but throughout the state, we must find a way to keep private landowners on the land and doing the right thing. Otherwise, we're going to lose most of the really wonderful ecological services that we get from private land. And here's one that relates directly to this watershed. Between 4 and 5% of the annual rainfall in the Pertinalis watershed goes right back into the Trinity Aquifer and produces 70,000 acre feet of water. But just basically each year, when it's raining, we produce, through recharge into the Trinity, 70,000 acre-feet of water. There's about 24% of the flow of the Pedernales going into the lower Colorado River, provides water for over 1 million people in the lower part of the watershed. So we're providing water for more than 1 million people downstream of us when it's raining. So the proper management and care and ability of landowners to stay on the property means everything to those Texans that are now mostly living in urban areas. And our biggest challenge is to get them to understand that, that private landowners are providing a service that simply cannot be bought, and that is a good stewardship of private property. And that's what we want to talk about tonight in this watershed. I'm going to introduce to you a wonderful panel that's going to discuss this issue tonight. What I'm going to do is that I'm going to introduce them all at once, and then I'm going to call on them each to make a short statement about what they do and why they're interested, why they're here tonight, and what is going on in their lives and institutions. And then we'll have a discussion among ourselves, and then we'll open the question and answer up to you, open to you all, so we can have a dialogue with each of you as well. And we want to hear from you tonight, because we're going to ask you some questions. First, we have, Bob was talking about the fact that I worked at Parks and Wildlife for a long time, and I don't have many regrets about that. But one is that I left there before Tim Birdsong arrived, because he has transformed the culture of one of the most important parts of the agency and has made it a vital component of habitat conservation. Tim is the chief of freshwater habitat conservation at Parks and Wildlife, and he's chairman of the Southeast Aquatic Resources Partnership, and that means all of the 15 southeastern states. In that role, he coordinates a variety of conservation efforts across the South, focused on preserving the fish and wildlife habitat in rivers and streams, not only in Texas, but throughout the southern U.S. Next, we have Clinton Bailey, who's probably no stranger to many of you. Clinton is the Director of Public Works and Utilities here in Fredericksburg. He's been involved in public works for over 18 years. Over that time, he has contributed to the planning, the engineering, the construction of a number of different water supply, treatment, and water conservation projects. He's a licensed professional engineer and a graduate in civil engineering from the University of Texas at Austin, with an emphasis on water resources management. Mark Steinbach is the executive director of one of Texas' most remarkable conservation organizations, the Texas Land Conservancy. He has previously worked as a wildlife biologist for Parks and Wildlife, and he holds a BS and an MS in wildlife management from A&M and a PhD in forestry from the University of Montana. We have two great landowners from the region with us tonight. The first, Pam Bergman, actually began her career as an attorney in 1975 at the Texas Water Rights Commission, the agency which is one of the predecessors of today's Texas Commission on Environmental Quality. She and her husband, Kim, who is also here, live in Blanco County and have been committed to good land stewardship and wildlife conservation for over 20 years. In 2013, they donated a conservation easement on their Gillespie County Ranch to the Hill Country Land Trust, and I see that Bill Lindeman and other members of that great organization are here, and Pam serves as a board member of the Hill Country Land Trust. Lastly, Howard Hicks' family has been ranching in the Texas Hill Country for over 150 years. That experience and that heritage has led him and his family also to place their ranch in a conservation easement, which sets the parameters on how the land can be developed as well as how the resources are to be conserved. His agricultural economics and range science training have been influential to help him improve the range condition of the land to conserve soil and water resources. And Howard is a senior executive at Hope Cat. So join me in welcoming these people. And invite Tim Birdsong to begin the discussion.
I want to talk a little bit about our interest in conserving the Pedernales River, Pedernales River watershed. And I want to begin by providing a little bit of context for the work that Texas Parks and Wildlife Department does in rivers and streams statewide. And I know you're probably most familiar with our role in managing state parks, wildlife management areas, state natural areas, some of those public lands that that our agency helps to drive that mission forward of conserving the natural and cultural resources of Texas and providing public access and use of those fish and wildlife resources, providing those conservation-oriented recreation opportunities for current and future generations of Texans. You're probably also familiar with the role of our game wardens, and they all play significant roles in conserving rivers and streams, but we also have fish and wildlife biologists. I'm a fish biologist, and I want to talk specifically about our work. And that primarily surrounds status and trend surveys of fish and wildlife populations and their habitats throughout the state, and we use that information, we use that science to inform a variety of regulatory and permitting processes, policy initiatives that are undertaken by the legislature and other groups, and also we lead a variety of voluntary conservation initiatives with funding for landowner incentives, technical guidance, planning assistance to landowners to help restore fish and wildlife habitats and provide conditions and watersheds that are going to help support healthy rivers and streams. And that's a big focus of what we do in the Hill Country. But backing up a bit, these regulatory processes, you may not know what role our agency plays. We use that science on the needs of fish and wildlife to help address water withdrawals from rivers and streams, water rights permitting decisions. We're involved in major stormwater and wastewater management projects. We're involved in influencing dam and hydropower operations. We have a role in major urban development projects that affect wetlands and rivers and streams and ensuring that those projects avoid, minimize, and mitigate impacts to fish and wildlife populations and their habitats. And so those are the regulatory roles. And in this past year, in 2013, we consulted on over 80 major development projects statewide. And over the last 5 years, we've consulted on projects affecting over 1,000 miles of rivers and streams. And this urbanization that Andy spoke of has a significant impact on the health of our rivers and streams. And the health of those rivers and streams is dependent upon healthy, functional watersheds and essential processes that occur. And that includes things like natural land cover that support spring recharge and affect water quality in streams, functional riparian zones that manage for natural levels of inputs of sediment and nutrients and provide connections between terrestrial and aquatic food webs. And a significant portion of the diet of many of our fishes found in these rivers and streams are terrestrial insects that come out of those trees and vetation along those riparian corridors. And as well as natural flow regimes and connectivity, the fragmentation that Andy spoke of on the landscape, that same fragmentation is occurring within our rivers and streams through poorly designed low water crossings and low head dams and other sorts of structures that can really affect the ability of fish and other aquatic organisms to move up and downstream. So these surveys that we conduct, we really try to influence decision-making processes so that those natural watershed conditions, those processes I just spoke of, can be restored and preserved. And that's going to support the health of our rivers and streams. It's going to result in more resilient rivers and streams. And the Hill Country is just you may be surprised by some of these figures, but we just conducted an economic impact study of stream fishing in the Texas Hill Country. And most anglers are targeting Guadalupe bass, and Hill Country stream fishing generated over $74 million last year. So it's significant. And if you think of the number of fly fishing guides and bed and breakfasts and other groups that specifically cater to fly anglers in Hill Country, it's significant. It's growing. And another number I'll throw out there is that over the last 10 years, we've seen about a 300% increase in the percentage of Texans, or the number of Texans, that participate in paddle sports. And nationwide, it's one of the fastest growing segments of the outdoor recreation industry. And the majority of those Texans that are paddling are targeting Hill Country rivers and streams. And so we have this amazing recreational resource and the opportunity to try to connect those recreational users with landowners and with municipalities and with other groups that care for this region to really build this level of support that's going to allow for some meaningful conservation to happen. I mean, we're primed for these opportunities to occur. We're moving forward with work, trying to bring together a network of landowners and anglers and other users in several different Hill Country watersheds. Our focus has been on the Llano for the last few years. We're just now picking up work in the Pernales River watershed, and I'll talk more about that as this panel discussion moves along.
Thank you, Tim. Mark Steinbach has and his organization have adopted the Pernales watershed as one of its priority areas around the state of Texas. So, Mark, can you tell us a little bit about the Texas Land Conservancy and why the focus on the Pernales?
The Texas Land Conservancy is a statewide organization, which is a little bit of a daunting task, but we currently have over 100 projects statewide, about 85,000 acres that we protect, primarily using conservation easements with private landowners. Historically, though, we have done a lot of work in the Hill Country. Right now in the Pernales Basin, we have about 14 projects, about 4,000 acres protected. When we looked a few years ago at where our projects were located and where Texas had need, we did a detailed assessment of all the different counties based on growth trends, on fragmentation patterns, on market land values, and it stood out to us very obviously that the Pernales was in kind of a tipping point. Is that there was a tremendous pressure being put onto the landscape in terms of growth and fragmentation. There's also tremendous opportunity for the conservation that needed to go on in that area. And so we've identified a few different river and watershed systems around the state, and one of those being the Pernales, in particular because we had such a big presence here already. And one of those landowners, like I said, is Howard here, and he can speak a little bit more to the logic behind why they chose that for their landscape. But we have our project is called Land for Water, and so the idea being is that every drop of rain that falls in Texas, as Andy said, pretty much falls on private lands. And so if we can't protect those landscapes, if we can't better manage those landscapes, that water is going to be lost or it's not going to be conserved in the best way possible. And so the idea behind this is working with landowners to achieve that conservation and at the same time achieve the water conservation that we need in the state.
Thank you, Mark. Clinton, we're all focused on the drought, and I'm going to let you have the opportunity to tell us here at Fredericksburg how you guys are beginning to address a drought and whatever else you have in mind about your operation.
Oh, sure, and depending on who you talk to, the drought that we're experiencing now is close to the drought of record. As a lot of you know, it's been really dry across the state. We've been looking at rainfall patterns and weather patterns since the early 1900s, just watching and forecasting out. It doesn't seem like there's any relief in sight. There are a lot of communities faced with this across the state of Texas and the United States, and it's a tough situation. There are a lot of things that we're doing locally to plan for this and accommodate this. Before I get into that, I guess I should tell you that I'm the new kid on the block here. I've been in Fredericksburg for about a year now. I come from West Texas, a drought-stricken San Angelo in West Texas, so I can tell you a whole lot more about who I was than who I think I am now. But I'm learning very quickly. I'm very excited about a lot of the programs that we have going on here. To begin with, the city is required to have a drought contingency plan. A drought contingency plan is a five-year plan on a five-year update through the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality. Within that drought contingency plan, we have things like watering restrictions. For those of you that are from Fredericksburg, you know that we're going through a revision of our watering restrictions ordinance right now. And it's very important that people understand that we need to conserve water. We need to conserve water in everything that we do. Another document that that we're required to submit is a water conservation plan to the Texas Water Development Board. We've done that. We're doing a number of programs in Fredericksburg in addition to those things, trying to set the example, trying to practice what we preach. We have things from a water rate adjustment this year. It doesn't seem like that would be a water conservation measure in times of drought, but when your water rates are high, you tend to use a little bit less water and turn to more efficient irrigation techniques and just be a little bit more water conscious. We have AMR smart meters in Fredericksburg that I know is not a real popular topic with some people, but it certainly helps the city of Fredericksburg identify water leaks, people that are and commercial businesses that may be abusing that water and so forth. We are on the third phase of a leak detection program right now. We started out with about a 15% water loss in Fredericksburg. We think we've whittled that down to a little bit over 5% now. So that's significant in terms of overall volume of water and how many additional people you can add to a population to accommodate that right there. We're doing a lot of reuse of reclaimed water. We treat to a type of wastewater effluent that can be applied directly to ball fields when people are present. We use a lot of roughly 35 to 40% of our wastewater effluent to irrigate our municipal golf course and also a private golf course just outside of town. We just signed a contract and council approved a contract with the school district here in Fredericksburg just earlier this week to utilize that water. So we're looking for opportunities to do that, also to conserve water. Public education is another big one, raising awareness. You know, a lot of times, people like me and a lot of people in the audience are stuck in their old ways of doing things, and we don't want to hear new ways to conserve water and so forth. I think this effort probably starts with the kids at a very young age. It's kind of like the no smoking campaign. You know, you drive that into their heads and they tell their mom, hey, you need to quit smoking. You know, well, you need to quit wasting water. So we're just starting a campaign in the local schools here. We had a poster contest, a logo contest. So we're doing a lot of work in that regard to raise awareness from, you know, the young kids all the way up. It takes everybody in a community like this to make a difference. Just because I conserve water, just because I'm conscious of the drought, doesn't make a difference, but when the 10,000 people in combination live here, all have good information, and they're all going the same direction with this, it makes a huge difference overall. So a lot of things going on in Fredericksburg, and there's just a lot of things that we've already got in the works that have already been implemented. That will help us conserve in times of drought, and we're always looking forward to new ways of doing that. It's something that I take very seriously, and it's something that I hold very dear to me.
Thanks, Clinton. Pam, I know the drought is affecting you all as landowners, and I'd be really interested to hear from you what experiences you're having as a result of these weather conditions, and probably more importantly, why you and Kim have chosen to protect your ranch in this way.
My husband and I grew up in Port Arthur, where the water's mostly brown. And so when we got to the hill country, we fell in love with the clear water and the stone-lined creek bottoms. And in fact, our first date in 1988 was to Pernell's Falls. And so it's interesting that many years later, we end up buying land in the Pernell's watershed, happily so. We went overseas and worked for 15 years so we could buy some land. And the realtor looked at us kind of puzzled because we said, well, we want to look at some land that has a whole lot of cedar on it. Well, ignorance on our part. We didn't know the invasive nature of the cedar. Number two, if I squinted at it, it reminded me of the pine trees of East Texas, which I loved. And number three, we lived on Lake Travis, and there were these majestic old-growth cedar trees that we just thought, that cedar, God, we love it. So we ended up buying 685 acres in Gillespie County that was covered up in cedar. We had to, he had to go with the chainsaw, and other than the pasture roads, we had to go down the creek bed to explore the property. And it was a straight up learning curve for us. For instance, we thought, oh, well, we're never going to get bulldozers on this property. It'll scar the land. Well, you have to break up the caliche. And it just, it's been an ongoing, wonderful learning curve for us. Thomas Hammer in NRCS in Fredericksburg really helped us. And early on, we bought all the books in the Historical Society store and read about the Germans with the grassland savannas. And that's not what we were seeing, and we were confused. And so Thomas began talking about the native grass, and we began clearing and buying the native seed and learning that with the tall grass, like switchgrass, with the deep root system, an inch of rain is equivalent to like a foot of rain on some other non-conserved area. And it's been a wonderful adventure doing that. We cleared the flat areas, the tops of the plateaus, left the cedar on the steep slopes, planted native grass. We've done two prescribed burns, which have made a huge difference in terms of what cedar does come back. And Thomas was just really so helpful, and Johnny was managing the property next to us, and of course with his experience and lots of advice, and we were just sponges soaking it all up. And when we would clear, we would do it in stages, so there would never be an erosion problem. There would always be a lower contour grass that had been established already. And then of course we became aware of people like Bamberger and the tremendous results of doing that sort of work on your property. And we saw the same thing. Springs began flowing more, the creeks, the seepy areas. It was a wonderful thing to behold. Now, you asked specifically about the drought. All but one of our tanks are dry. One never dries up. One of our springs has never gone dry, and it's okay, but it's really sad. And we are now going to be focusing more on wildlife habitat. And I don't know if other areas of the state look at the skies, at the weather report every day. We do several times a day. And as far as the conservation easement, we wondered with three children, and that was what we had worked for our adult lives, to buy that land, if they would be concerned about us limiting it with the conservation easement. In fact, they were thrilled because they watched how passionate we are. A good day for us is to go out and work on our land and lop cedar. And their only question when we told them that's what we were intending to do was just how much cedar lopping were they going to be required to do. Other than that, it was okay.
Howard, you've been a part of a family that has a tremendous legacy on the landscape here. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that legacy and your landowner story?
I grew up in Bandera County, and my great-grandfather over there came into Bandera County in 1855, but my great-great-grandfather in Gillespie County beat him. He came here in 1854, so my mom's side of the family had land over here, so we ended up over here, but I grew up and lots of 4-H activities, judging willow mohair, livestock, and I think the thing that's helped me the most was the range that we did, and learning the grasses and learning how to judge range plots and those things. And you might be interested that our county agent was Warner Lindig, who most of y'all know Lindig's here in Gillespie County. That's where he came from, so he was a great role model for us. Went to A&M, majored in agricultural economics, but took some range science courses and always stayed interested in it. And now that I've gotten older, and some of the older generation have died out, have the opportunity to help manage our land. So the ranch we have is in on the Gillespie-Blanco County line, almost up to Llano County. It's out northeast of Willow Spring, Willow City. And we operated that ranch there for 150 years, and they did a fair job of managing the range, but we've had some opportunities to improve it, and contrary to Pam there, I've been cutting cedar trees down all my life, so nothing new about that. But we've done a lot of juniper clearing to improve the rangeland, to improve the amount of water. I think one thing that hasn't been mentioned is that if you've got a large canopy of juniper, well, almost none of that water ever gets to the ground. So it makes a tremendous amount of difference in how much water gets into the ground, which replenishes our springs, which flows into the rivers, has a tremendous impact on the watersheds. It also improves the grasses for the wildlife. There's going to be more forbs, that sort of thing, for the wildlife. And we do try to manage our wildlife right, and we work with Texas Parks and Wildlife on our game management. And we try to control our grazing so that we don't overgraze the land. As I've grown up, I've seen a lot of damage to the land from overgrazing, and I think that's one of the things that we really have to be careful about. And you get into the economics, well, if I have more cattle or more sheep or more goats, well, I'm going to make more money. Well, that's only to a certain point. If you don't take care of your grasses, it's going to be worse in the long run. So we try to manage our range, and we've seen some definite improvement in the varieties and the quantity of grass we have. And just the more grass we have, the more organic matter we're going to have, the more water we're going to have, and try to rebuild some of that soil that's been lost over the years. But I think Andy explained it best. He talks about the amount of land that's being lost in Texas every year to urban development. And that's something that's really bothered me. I grew up in Bandera County, and if you know anything about Bandera County, it's just about covered up with subdivisions. There's very few old ranches left there, or wasn't much farmland to begin with like there is here. So it concerned me about the way the country is being cut up. So we had a neighbor who did a conservation easement here in Gillespie County, and happened to do it with Mark, which was a good thing. And so he was kind of talking to us about it, and then one of my sons went into investigating about what was involved in a conservation easement and went to a seminar with the Texas Land Trust that they put on every year and learned a lot about it. And we decided that that was something that we wanted to seriously consider with our family. So we brought Mark in, and we sat down with three generations down to the youngest grandkids, and we said, this is what's involved in a conservation easement. And if we do this conservation easement, which in our case, we wanted to make it where the land could never be subdivided at all. You don't have to limit it that much, but that's one of the options. And we got everybody's buy-in that they wanted to keep the land just as it was, as much as we could, for future generations. So we did that with 175 acres of land that we had, just my immediate family. And then we have a partnership with some cousins next door, and we're able to convince them that that was a good thing, and they wanted to preserve the land as well. So we added another 1,400 acres, and we're talking to some cousins that are in the area about doing with their land. And I know 1,600 acres, or with our neighbor, it's 1,800. That's not a lot of land, but it's a start. And if people don't do something to conserve the land, there's not going to be any natural land left here. It's going to be all cut up into subdivisions and houses and roads and impervious cover. And you've heard Tim talk about the impact that has on the watershed and the water quality. And our state is in a bad shape. I'm sure you're all well aware of it, the water situation. And one way to improve that situation is to have more land that has good grass cover and get more water in, replenish our springs, put good quality water back into our lakes. So that's just a little bit that we can contribute.
Thank you, Howard. So let me give you a local example about how bad this problem is. You know, you all remember that a couple of years ago, a crew went through here and took out a pipeline out of Gillespie County that had been laid in 1928. When that pipeline was laid, the company that laid it crossed about 10 landowners. When the pipeline was removed in 2012 and 2013, they crossed over 1,000 landowners. Tim, I mentioned to you earlier, you all earlier, that Catherine Romans is here from the Hill Country Alliance. She's in charge of an outreach program that helps landowners understand the opportunities there are from entities like Parks and Wildlife. So I'd like to turn the mic back over to Tim for a minute and get Tim to tell us about the Landowner Incentive Program and what the opportunities there are in that program and how it works.
You may be familiar with some of the NRCS technical guidance programs or possibly AgriLife or some of these other organizations that provide guidance and planning assistance and maybe even some grants or other sorts of cost share incentives to support some of the land management that we've talked about already. We've had a program at Texas Parks and Wildlife for at least 10 years now, known as the Landowner Incentive Program. And it's a similar program that provides cost share incentives to landowners to conserve natural landscapes, but with a focus on benefiting some of our focal species of fish and wildlife. And most of the projects that we've funded historically targeted imperiled species of birds and big game species. But more recently, we've shifted gears a bit. We began to focus on managing ranch lands to benefit a fish, Guadalupe bass. And so over the last 3 years, we've targeted funding towards 27 different ranches in the Hill Country, mostly within the Llano River watershed. And Megan Bean, who's in the audience, Gary Garrett, who's in the audience, who are both based at our office in Mountain Home, Heart of the Hills Fishery Science Center, they've partnered closely with some of our wildlife technical guidance biologists, who many of you have likely worked with, and visited ranches, looked for opportunities to improve the condition of specific features, these critical habitat features that are going to have an effect on water quality and habitat quality in rivers and streams. So opportunities to restore springs and opportunities to improve the condition of these riparian zones that I talked about. And those 27 ranches, those encompass nearly 80,000 acres of the Llano watershed. And currently we have about 2,700 acres of active restoration projects underway on those properties. And again, cost shared with the landowner one-to-one. And if you visited our Landowner Incentive Program website on the Texas Parks and Wildlife website, you'll see that we have a number of different funding programs that we've cobbled together from a number, it's federal funding sources, private donations, all these different organizations nationwide, really, that are excited about what we're trying to do here, and specifically in the Texas Hill Country. And it really has not been difficult to get access to these funds and drive those towards landowners that want to be these good stewards of the land. And what we're really trying to do is build networks of landowners in these focal watersheds that collectively can have a significant and lasting impact on the health of these watersheds. I talked about those watershed conditions earlier. What we've seen is there's a tipping point. Once you reach alteration within a watershed, once you see a level of urbanization and that impervious cover, there's a tipping point where you start to see significant loss of water quality and your native fish assemblage and other aquatic life. And surprisingly, it's about 5 to 10%. From 5 to 10%, with 5 to 10% urban impervious cover in a watershed, you start to see significant changes in the health of rivers and streams. And right now, I looked at our land cover data set before I came here, and the Pernalis watershed is about 1.7% impervious cover, and that's similar to most Hill Country watersheds. And I think that's unique among Texas river basins and watersheds, and that there's still, I look at it as a preservation opportunity here in the Hill Country. We're out ahead of the issues that we're experiencing in a lot of the more urbanized watersheds in the state. And so there's really this unique opportunity to restore and preserve. And once you reach the level of degradation that you see in areas like the Upper Trinity River watershed in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, or think of any number of other urban rivers, the cost of trying to restore a river, it's got to be in the hundreds of millions or billions of dollars. But you've got to have healthy, quality rivers and streams, flowing rivers and streams. Got to have water if you're going to support fish and wildlife. So those processes, the habitats, that's foremost. And then hopefully following that will be, again, sustainable populations of fish and wildlife. So.
Thanks. Now I'm going to ask Catherine Romans to take this extra microphone up here and then open the discussion up to those of you in the audience who would like to have your way with us. Yes, sir. This gentleman in the front row.
I'm Robert Deming. I've seen some stuff about Africa and the Middle East and what they call desertification, and it looks awful out there from what I see now. Are we headed there? Is that where what our future is if we don't deal with this?
I think that that is a big question. I think that there are people who believe that if this condition that we're in continues, that Austin will be more like San Angelo in our lifetimes, and the desert will move eastward. I get up every day and pray for rain, and I don't think anybody knows at this point in time where the end of this is, if it, there is an end. I can tell you that one of the things that happened to us in Austin was we, as you all of you know, we had a horrible flood on Halloween and, you know, destroyed 300 homes, and it was a major flood. But I know there are people in this room that remember that in the absolute teeth of the drought of record, what we call the drought of record in the 1950s, it rained 26 inches over this town in 15 hours, and Pert Niles went up 48 feet at Stonewall and 60 feet at Hamilton Pool Road. And where it entered Lake Travis, it was flowing at 3/4 the flow of the Mississippi River, but it did not in the drought. So I just don't think that we can assume that this is going to be over anytime soon, and I think that's one of the reasons why these improved stewardship practices are more important than they've ever been. Yes, back over here.
We're kind of talking about folks with lots of land. I mean, that's sort of been the majority of our discussion tonight. But what about us just city dwellers, you know? We just live in the city. We got a little house in the city. So, what can we do to address some of the issues? I mean, what are good stewardship practices for us besides, you know, running our sprinklers all the time or whatever?
Are you asking about water conservation, stormwater management?
You know, does the city, are there any incentives in the city for me to put gutters on my tin roof and water collect, or are there incentives? What's the city stance on people using graywater and things like that?
Right. We don't have any incentives in place right now, and I know that a lot of communities do have those in place. A lot of communities have successful programs such as that. You know, the number of things that I mentioned earlier regarding the water conservation measures that we're taking, we're trying to get a little bit more information, good information, out to the community. We've just gone through this revision of our watering restriction ordinance. And one of the things that we've added in there is drip irrigation. You know, in stage 4 of our watering restrictions, you can only water 4 times. We're proposing you can only water 4 hours once per week. But if you have a drip irrigation system installed, you can water every day and just limit that use. So, you know, we're trying to be very flexible and, again, give people options to utilize that water more efficiently and do that smarter. Now, there's a lot of room for improvement in getting information out to the public in Fredericksburg. And we really haven't had to think about water conservation. It doesn't appear all that much in the past, but We're in a little bit more dire situation statewide right now, so expect to see a lot more information coming from the city. You know, things like stormwater runoff. I mentioned a couple of things earlier. When you fertilize your yard, just be cautious about broadcasting that in the street. When you apply herbicides and pesticides, just be careful, because that does end up in our creeks. It ends up in the Ferdinand River. We're working to get more information out to the public. We're working to get more information out to the school kids and so forth. But I expect to see a lot more of that. And this water conservation ordinance that we're working on is just one step in providing you those tools so that for everybody to use to better manage the situation that we're in.
Harris. I generally go crazy when I hear Texas Water Development Board talk about desired future conditions that in no way are desirable to me. And I don't see anyone it seems to me it would be very simple. It wouldn't be binding on anybody, but somewhere we need to make the public aware of if, for example, we've lost half of our historically significant springs since the 1970s. They tell me desired future condition of Colorado River in 2060 is going to be negative flow. I think if we, there are things that can be done that would make the desired future condition all historically significant springs flowing. Our river flow, as I understand it, takes about 30 or 40% of its flow from spring flow. So a good place would be to say, okay, folks, if we want this condition, this is what this think tank thinks we need to do. Whether the legislature falls in line and does it, if the people change the constitution, if whatever, but at least if we show people this is what you can do and it'll make a difference on your additional population, we ought to have a plan that says, not binding on anybody, but if you come into this community, you need to show how are we going to help that person be zero impact on that spring flow, on the aquifers. We need to bring the aquifers back to where they were. To me, everybody coming in, if they had rainwater harvesting, will that solve it? No. Should they have a well? Maybe they need a well. But it seems there are a lot of different things we can do. Eventually, we may need to convert storm water systems into water collection systems. We do a lot of things, but I don't see anybody doing anything except, woe is me, this is what it's going to be. We're helpless. And Texans aren't helpless.
Well, a couple of responses. I mean, one is a real positive one, and that is that the Speaker of the House has issued an interim study to the House Natural Resources Committee to look at that very issue. So the legislature will be considering a means of protecting spring flow and incentivizing landowners to do so during the interim. I think that the biggest problem we have, and it's also an opportunity for us, whether we live on a ranch or in town, is that during what we call a drought of the 50s, everybody lived on a farm or a ranch, or they lived in a small town, or their mother and dad worked in a feed store. And so when the drought came, everybody knew exactly what was happening. Today, 85% of our citizens live in about four or five metropolitan areas, and as long as the kids go in the bathroom and flush the toilet or water comes out of the tap, they think everything's okay. And so without getting depressed, you know, people often ask folks like all of us, what can I do? What can I do? Every single one of us, no matter what we do in our lives, can find a way during the course of a year to take a kid fishing or take a kid and put them in a spring or put them in the river and have them understand that this is an incredible source of joy for them and pleasure and spiritual renewal, but it's also a resource that they're going to have to take responsibility for, and everyone can do that. Yes, sir. Bill.
Yeah, I'd like to say that you need to go just a little bit further after you go fishing. When you get back home and you turn the water faucet on and you just let it run, and you got to connect the dot. I think children and adults, and I think we can teach the children easier and let them teach their parents how to touch a water faucet. Something really simple. And until we start talking those terms, and the same thing with what can we do when we know 70% of our clean drinking water goes on watering landscapes, and nobody yet is talking about drilling in, oh yeah, what's a landscape? Oh, it's St. Augustine grass. What is St. Augustine? It's a native of the Caribbean. You know, what in the hell is it doing at 2,000 feet above sea level in these rocks? It rains 160 inches in the Caribbean. It rains over here 20. We're not even talking about the right stuff. 70% of the water is going on landscapes. If you want more water, look at the landscape. Asian jasmine, Chinese holly, India hawthorn, Japanese boxwood, the name, Pakistan crepe myrtle, the state shrub.
Final question.
Is the Pertinellas under a river authority?
Somebody with a microphone answer that question a little bit more specifically.
Yeah, the LCRA. Only part of it. It doesn't go all the way up the watershed, but through Blanco County. Not all of Blanco County, just the parts in Travis County.
Here's a couple of final takeaways for you. The population of our state is expected to double in the next 50 years. And yet, we have already given permission for more water to be taken from most of our rivers than is actually in them today. So this, probably more than any other fact, sums up this dilemma. The second takeaway is that I, frankly, was grateful and supportive that the state of Texas and the leadership has provided funding for people like Clinton to build infrastructure to help us solve this problem. But the thing that we must not misunderstand is that we cannot build our way out of this. And one of the things that we must do is to work with private landowners to protect these watersheds and keep them on the land and doing the right thing. When I worked with these wonderful people at Texas Parks and Wildlife, it came to me that if the state legislature gave the Parks and Wildlife Department the entire state budget for a year, I mean for everything, to buy land with, it would only change the amount of land in public ownership in Texas by 1% or so. So this job has to be done by helping private landowners such as many of you here in the room. And I can tell you that we're all grateful for what you do and appreciative of the good job that you've done, and we want to keep you doing it. Have a very nice evening, and thanks for being here.